then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flushing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's February the 28th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, last week's more or less monologue on my part generated a few comments and questions, as I think you can imagine. Now, I'm not going to get back into the subject of the space madness itself, because, like I said, I want last week's show to be my ultimate stand-alone comment on the topic, if that turns out to be possible. I hope it will. But some of the email questions and comments need to be addressed. First off, one young comrade in Britain has become rather irate over some comments I've made down through the months about young white guys living in their parents' basements. I managed once again to transfer the email to my Word program here without saving the guy's name, but I think it's James. Anyway, James writes, "Dear HAC, Brits who leave their folks' homes risk putting their families out on the street because the British government has introduced a new tax on so-called empty bedrooms. England is completely overcrowded due to 60 years of non-stop mass immigration from both the Third World and the continent. In addition to that, many British adults literally can't afford to move out of their folks' homes ever because there are no jobs. Take a look at this article from the Daily Mail dated February the 13th, which demonstrates why. And I'm going to interrupt here to read a portion of that article. Basically, it deals with a coffee chain in Britain, which is kind of the UK equivalent of Starbucks, called Costa Coffee. They recently opened a new shop in Nottingham, England, and they advertised 8 jobs working as what we would call a barista here in this country. Over 1,700 people applied for those 8 jobs. That's 212 applications for each job. Now, it says here, and I quote, "Unsuccessful applicants for the vacancies included senior retail managers with more than 15 years' experience. Many applicants were actually hugely overqualified. More than 90% of the applicants came from Nottingham, and we didn't have to advertise that extensively either." This is the store manager talking now. Okay, back to James from London. "I apply to roughly 20 vacancies each and every week, and nothing happens, except the occasional one or two monthly replies telling me that they can't employ me. And I have a university degree. Now, the only way I can move out of my mother's basement is to claim unemployment benefits and get told by the state to work full-time in Poundland for $3 an hour. Now, by the way, he's not exaggerating, unless they've changed since I was last employed there in the early 1990s. Britain has no legal minimum wage." James goes on to ask, quote, "Am I a useless dysfunctional?" Okay, fair enough. First off, James, just to let you know, I not only know what it is to be unemployed, I know what it is to be unemployed in London, and to be not sure where your 40 quid rent for the crappy bedsitter is coming from at the end of the week, although now I imagine it's worse. Now, my New Zealand girl Jan and I were paying £200 a week for a really, really crappy one-bedroom flat in Leighton in 1992. We were both working, and we were slaves to that weekly rent, so yes, I know what housing costs are like in London, and that was 20 years ago. I shudder to think what it's like now. And yes, I've heard of the empty bedrooms tax that the British government has imposed in order to try and force all the working class and most middle class white people to become boarding housekeepers. Now, these laws will come into effect in April of this year, And what it is that if you're poor or long-term unemployed middle class, or what used to be middle class, and you're on some kind of government benefit, which under Marxist socialism, a huge number of white people as well as non-whites in Britain are. Anyway, if you have any unoccupied bedrooms in your house, you get your benefits cut, your unemployment dole or your housing benefit, etc. And if you live in council housing, that is where the government is your landlord, as millions of British people do under social democracy, you can be evicted unless you rent out any spare rooms you have, presumably to non-white immigrants in many cases. Yeah, the glories of political correctness and diversity in a society with no guns to defend themselves. Okay, granted, we're not doing any better here in this country. We still have the guns, for the time being anyway, but they're simply lying in our closets and our gun cabinets, gathering dust and rusting away. There's not much point in having the Second Amendment if you're not going to use it for the purpose for which it was intended. How many of you remember enough history from back in the days when real history was actually taught in the schools to recall that one of the causes of the American Revolution was the British quartering troops in the colonists' homes? That's even specifically prohibited in the Constitution. Well, now they're quartering niggers and Muslims in white people's homes back in the mother country. Looks like those Minutemen back in 1775 knew what they were doing. According to an article I found on the net, an estimated 670,000 homes will be affected by this new empty bedrooms law at first. As I read this, you get one bedroom per working age adult or couple. Doesn't say anything at all about children I can find so far, although I assume if you're a married couple, you can at least get one extra bedroom allocated for any kids. Anyway, if you're over your allotment of bedrooms in your house, and if you have one empty room which could conceivably be used as a bedroom, and bear in mind, what's a bedroom is going to be defined by some state bureaucrat or left-wing labor council, then you have to rent that room out or else you get your benefits pulled, which for many working-class British families who have been unemployed, some of them for years, will be catastrophic. They'll have to rent out that room if they want to stay in their home and not end up on the streets or in the shelter. And presumably all those anti-racist laws over there will then kick in to make sure that their new unwanted house guests are some shade of black or brown. There will apparently be some kind of army of government inspectors descending on English housing estates and neighborhoods in April, looking to see who's got spare bedrooms where new immigrants from Nigeria or Albanian Muslims can be jammed in. No, swear to God, I'm not making this up. Look it up for yourself on the internet if you don't believe me. It is entirely possible under this new law that some white family with a teenage daughter could be forced to rent a room to some 6'3" Jamaican drug dealer and give him a key to the house. I'm sure the British tabloid press will give us all kinds of juicy coverage of the resulting horror stories when they occur, as they will. Now, do you see now, guys, why we have a Second Amendment? Let me ask you, what do you think the dictatorship is going to do? This is the dictatorship here now, not in Britain. How do you think these people will act once they succeed in disarming you or else forcing you to hide and bury your guns out in the woods where you can't get at them if you need them? Now, that's almost as good for their purpose as confiscating the weapons would be. Obama wants American white people defenseless, and if you can't get at your guns when the militarized police and the black body armor kick in your door because they're buried in cosmoline out in somebody's barn, then from their point of view, that's just as good as confiscation. You can't defend yourself, which is what they want. James, I wish to hell I could do something for you, brother. I swear to God I would if I could, but you're stuck in Airstrip 1 and the society I live in simply does not want and will not allow white immigration. If you were to come here and try to work illegally like you were Mexican or Somali or something, as soon as you were caught, the ICE would simply throw your pale ass on the next jet for Heathrow. Obama's moratorium on deporting illegals doesn't apply to white people, only to blacks and browns, who will, in the fullness of time, become registered Democrats and vote to keep the ruling party in power. It's a pity, because we could probably help you, but legal immigration is damn near impossible if you have a white skin. Now, we have a Swedish comrade who's been trying to come here legally since last summer, and he hasn't even gotten to first base. It's a damn shame because there are still jobs here. Not good jobs, depending on your skill set, but so far, no one who has ever migrated to the Seattle area anyway has been without a job for more than about 4 weeks tops. I have to say that here in this area and throughout the Northwest, as terrible as the Obama Depression has been and still is, and as devastated as countless millions of white families have been in America, there are starting to be some small signs of economic recovery, although how long those will last once Obamacare starts kicking in next year, and all of a sudden we're all being flayed alive to the bone to pay for it, I don't know. I wish to hell I could get all you British comrades over here with a legal green card that would allow you to seek and accept employment. On March 16th of 2012, I put up a special podcast on the NorthwestFront.org website called American Immigration for White Nationalists, in which I discuss the subject of possibly getting some of you over here. Now, if you're British or Canadian or Australian or whatever, you need to go to that podcast, March 16th, 2012, almost a year ago. Give it a listen. I think it would be great if the remaining 50 million or so white people in Great Britain would pack their bags and get the hell out and come here. Although, that's not going to happen, let's face it. The Weltfiend, the world enemy, wants to keep you all in your island prison. Sorry, I was digressing. Anyway, getting back to the subject, no, James, I don't think you're a useless dysfunctional. But you have to bear in mind that I was describing a situation that genuinely exists over here in this country, and it's a real problem. They even made a movie about it with Matthew McConaughey called Failure to Launch. Now, the white boy who's 32 years old and still living at home, glued to his computer and his video games, and who holds down some menial job or none at all, and who shows no ambition or any sense of responsibility, has become kind of a American cliché. Unfortunately, in the context in which I was speaking, this is a phenomenon that we have popping up here in ways we shouldn't have to put up with. If memory serves, I made that remark last week referring to two separate individuals who are, based on my information, living in their mother's basements, or at least with their parents, and who seem to have an awful lot of spare time. And the devil is making work for idle hands in their case. Now, we've raised an entire generation of white kids, especially white boys, who are completely clueless and directionless, who are completely devoid of any ambition and who will reproduce late and badly, if at all. Over here, and I imagine in Britain too, this is a serious problem, and we need to address it by somehow giving these young dumbasses something to live for besides a video game. Now, I know that many people, including yourself, James, are genuine victims of the system, caught in a cycle of moral hopelessness and economic stagnation of the kind that political correctness creates. Now, unfortunately, some of us don't have this thrust upon us. We choose it. It's an unpleasant fact of life, but a fact nonetheless, and one we have to deal with. Now, time for another quick question before the first music break. This is from Connor in Australia. He sent an email in response to my publication of Jake Lasky's White Resistance Manifesto on the Thought Crime blog last week. I won't read the whole email out, but the question is one I get asked every now and then, which is something to the effect of, "Dear Harold, why are you constantly baiting and mocking the FBI and the police? Are you trying to get yourself killed or framed or otherwise destroyed?" No, Connor, I'm not suicidal, and I won't tell you I know what I'm doing because maybe I don't. That could be I'm going to piss off some nigger in a suit and a big office with mahogany wastebaskets like Bill White did, and then the nigger or the Jew or the feminist bitch will pick up a phone and give the order and they're going to come for me in the dawn tomorrow. Who knows? And that's the point. Nobody does know. There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to it, no sense or discernible pattern in who they decide to destroy and who they let live. The government of the United States is a lot like that big, fat, slobby, little sadistic kid we all met at one point when we were young, the one who sits all alone and burns ants with a magnifying glass and pulls the wings off flies. Which may in itself be a very subtle form of institutional terrorism, keeping us guessing, wallowing in our sty with all the luxurious slop that America feeds us and wondering who the farmer with the butcher knife will come for next to be dragged off to the slaughtering block. Now, it's not as if actual crime has anything to do with it. That went by the boards long ago. People are getting arrested now for writing and publishing poems on the internet, like with Johnny Logan Spencer. For publishing information that can be found on Google in 2 minutes, like Bill White. Or getting 12 years in prison for breaking a window, like Jake Lasky. Or simply for no reason at all, like Edgar Steele, where the entire case was deliberately fabricated by the FBI from ground zero. Connor, how can I put this? somebody has to do and say what I do and say, and I'm actually pretty well qualified, only not for the reasons you might think. I'm well qualified because I'm almost 60 years old, I have no family, I have no money or property, and generally nothing to lose. In American law enforcement parlance, I have a short tail, nothing to grab onto. Now, others do, and I understand that's why so many people won't help me, or when they do, they cut and run at the first sign of trouble. Yeah, I know, I rant and rave about it all, and I'll continue to do so, but I'm not totally isolated from human reality. I know what I'm asking, and I know that most people aren't like me, and they do have something to lose. Yeah, they could scoop me up tomorrow and charge me with anything they want, give me a jury full of niggers and Seattle hippy-dippy 60s retreads, and slap me down in the cell next to Edgar Steele to die. But somebody's got to do it. Looks like I've drawn the short straw, and I'm good with that. After all, they can't take my youth. I've already misspent it. Everything I've said and done is mine now, and they can never take it, so fuck 'em. And no, I'm not trying to strike a pose and show you how brave I am. I'd be a lot braver if I was doing all this, but I was 25 years younger, and I had something to lose. Okay, music break. I'm in the mood for a nice, long, groovy, medieval murder ballad. This is one of those songs which has a lot of versions, English, Scottish, many different variations, probably a few Appalachian versions of the child ballads, etc. It's called Matty Groves. It's one of those songs where you get the impression that long ago, something happened. I'm really curious to know what it was, although, of course, we'll never know. Anyway, this is Fairport Convention.
And Good evening, comrades. Recently, I was sent several files, and one of them was on Chrishelm, and it was a translation of the Eddas. Now, I'm sure many of us have attempted to read various translations of the Eddas, and I would have to say that that's really a fairly difficult task because you're faced with a lot of verses that really don't necessarily make a lot of sense to us today. The reason for this, basically, it's twofold. First of all, a lot of the translations of the Eddas were done by individuals who were interested in literature and poetry, and they wanted to display various types of European or world literature to the audience, but they never imagined that anyone would take this literature seriously as a religion. So it's mainly translated for poetry and really for nothing else. And the other thing is that this literature was written in a certain cultural context. Because of the conversion to Christianity and the changes that came about in Western society as a result of that conversion, and probably also just the result of the passage of time, nowadays we're living in quite a different culture, and therefore we don't have the cultural background that the original readers had. So for that reason, the modern reader may well attempt to read translations of the Eddas, but may not really get very far. Now, the first thing to understand that this writer wants to tell us about is he reminds us that the Eddas really are a series of spells, and that they're written the way they are in part because there's a certain meaning in the sounds of the words and in the alliteration and in the types of runes that were originally used. So what this author does is he makes direct comparisons between the English and the Norse translations. Now, to just have a little background on Germanic religion, the author gives us a lot of notes, really, and he talks about this cosmic void called Ginn, which is a pantheistic, magical material from which the world is made. But the word Ginn can also indicate illusion. We have to understand that the cultural context, again, was different, and that the Germanic cosmos is never static. So we have kind of a cyclical or hot cosmos where there's the rebirth of the soul, and the soul can go through many heated cycles and can exist in various dimensions over time. That really, if we want to give the Eddas an application, it's supposed to be a practical manual for self-transformation. There's a lot of talk in the notes about how you have the conscious self and you want to delve into the personal and the collective unconscious to try to gain a higher awareness. There's a lot of talk of various polarities, and one of the important polarities is between the idea of the sun, which is an element of inspiration or heat, and then ice, which is a stable character, and how you have to have something of both. You can't have too much of either one. And that inspiration must be channeled. In order to develop awareness, you have to have an attentiveness, and silence is part of this attentiveness, but that you should not be asleep, because you seldom find victory if you sleep. There's a lot of sense, again, of this idea of the fetch as a metaphor for the higher self. As a practical example of the fetch, there were actually these women that would travel through the Germanic territories and would actually participate in divinatory rites. So they were kind of like seeresses. They would make various predictions. It was kind of like going to the Greek temples, and they would try to read signs, try to divine the future. That's kind of like what a bola is. There's also an important emphasis on using meditation and ceremony as a way to transform yourself and increase consciousness. The book goes into various specifics about various incantations and how you can adopt the myth to the present day, and explaining the various allegories that the myths portray. It's really about self-control and how positive energies can be used to displace negative energy, and how various negative emotions can be channeled and controlled, and actually there's even a control of positive emotions as well. Actually, there's so much to this that it's quite a bit to include in one show, but still, I hope you found this review helpful, and I would highly recommend that you read this book. So thank you very much for listening.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. One of the comments to Radio Free Northwest number 161 on Movement Gubu asked me to share my own migration story. I've done so already, but I'll rehash it enough to make a point about what really matters. I had initially drawn up notes that would have taken over half an hour on this topic, but I realized that probably wouldn't have been an appropriate thing to do, since the amount of background involved would really have been useless towards my main rhetorical thrust. So I canned that whole thing, and I'm giving you this material instead. I'll admit a couple of things up front. First, I'm actually going to skirt the comrade's question somewhat. I'll answer it quickly and move on to the substance behind it, since that's more important, and I can actually turn that into something applicable the whole audience can use if they want to. Secondly, I'm one of those people who has a job skill that usually gets calls from all over the country. This skill is what brought me to Seattle on my migration. This is somewhat irrelevant, however, since there wouldn't have been any migration if I weren't trying to migrate in the first place. Okay, sure, despite being obvious, that's actually more profound than it seems. But let me get started. My migration story fits the generic model recommended by the party. Shortly after finding the party, I did some serious soul-searching and research before committing to the Northwest Imperative. For about a year after that, I worked on general migration issues, and shortly after that year was up, I actually migrated with a job offer in hand. I did some job interviews in Seattle and did another scouting trip just to make sure I had a place to live when I arrived. I packed up my things and had a moving company take what I couldn't deal with on my own. Then I put everything I would need for the duration of the move and all my immediate living needs into my car and set out from Kansas City, Missouri, for Seattle, Washington. On October 3rd, 2011, I drove into Seattle and made my home there. During my migration attempts, the first thing I did was throw out or otherwise rid myself of items I knew I would not move with. When it was time to move, I had rooms full of furniture I didn't ever use except when guests were over, so I sold all of it. Further, I knew I needed to save money for the move regardless of how it happened. I had not been out of college very long when I found the Northwest Front, and despite having had lucrative work for a year, I encountered the Bush Bomber Depression and didn't have any real income for some time. I'd been battered by the economy just like everyone else, and I had only just begun to recover. I knew I would be able to pull off a migration into one of the cities in the Northwest since I had useful job skills and a quality work record, so I set to work on making that happen. I've dispensed plenty of job-related advice either on Radio Free Northwest or in emails to Mr. Covington, which he's forwarded to the rest of the mailing list. So I won't go over that again here since it's really off-topic. What is worth mentioning is that I very deliberately put myself out there to employers in the Pacific Northwest and did a lot of work on a regular basis to market myself as a potential employee. This included giving up many lunches to make phone calls to human resources departments, and long sessions of phone interviews with several different large, well-known companies. When I did really well, I'd get a follow-up phone interview. A couple of times, just about a year into my migration efforts, I was told a few different companies were interested in flying me to Seattle for face-to-face interviews. When this happens, it means they think you can do the job already, and they're just looking to see if they want to work with you. These trips happened back-to-back, and while I was in Seattle, I managed to hear from another company that wanted to interview me. So I interviewed with them as well. I'll pause for a moment and point out that every story from a migrant which has been aired on Radio Free Northwest involves one common element. Each migrant did a little bit of work every single day, or at least a fair amount of work each week. And they all took some sort of physical action to kick the process off. Every time I've had a difficult project for the party or my employers, nothing got done until I took the first step, and then it seemed like everything happened in the way it should once I got going. The small, consistent efforts are what end up paying off, but no action whatsoever will always guarantee failure. Now that I've done the main migration story, I need to make a more important observation. When I found the party website, I was ready to hear the message. More specifically, my mind was in the right place. Originally, I wasn't going to do this presentation at all, since I had already been interviewed about it on Radio Free Northwest. My migration story itself isn't so valuable because it consists of the basic elements of migration and few, if any, unique details. What made me change my mind was the opportunity to tell why I committed to migration and why I think we're having trouble making some sort of traction getting people to come up here. When I initially put this material together, it ended up including way too many anecdotes from my past and started to look a little too much like navel-gazing for my tastes, especially in response to such a simple question. So I decided to go for a quick summary of that material in support of my main point. Without going into a half-hour-long rant like I started to, what needs to be understood is that I was in a unique frame of mind to understand the Northwest Imperative when I was presented with the party website for the first time. Through my childhood and college lives, I had gone from being a born-and-raised Zionist neocon, since that's how my family was, to an anti-American and ever-so-slightly racial white guy that knew not to say certain things out loud. I don't want to go off on a huge story about that, since the details aren't so relevant. Let's just say that by accident, I finally realized a string of bizarre incidents through my whole life weren't coincidental, and there really was a race problem. Further, I had been accidentally exposed to the 14 words, though I never had any movement involvement. I didn't see anything wrong with the idea that white people should be permitted to survive and live in their own society, but the other white people around me couldn't stand that idea at all and actually flipped out over it. While working my first real job after finishing college, I couldn't shake the idea that there was some sort of racial problem I had only recently started to recognize. I knew white people got heaped on for no good reason, having had a string of incidents that I could look back on as an adult and see a pattern that a child could not. I knew I didn't really want anything to do with the white nationalist movement because, sadly, it's full of dumb human debris that I wouldn't be caught dead around, even if I did sort of agree with them. I got curious and wondered what the deal was with all that Holocaust denial stuff I heard about. Surely they're making that all up, right? Through college and into my adult life, I had met my first Jews and didn't get along with any of them at all. They were all dishonest, anti-Christian, though I knew that was just a cover for hating white people based on the things they said and the things they attacked, and they were all the stereotypical kike. Since I knew I didn't care for Spics, niggers, and any sort of Asian, I wondered if all that stuff about race was really true. Anyway, I got curious about Holocaust revisionism. I figured it was all hogwash and I'd be over it in 5 minutes. Nope, not at all. As it turns out, white nationalism was basically right, albeit filled with morons that are the worst representation of our race, if not every race. This sure was fun to deal with, what with my going to one of the most Zionist and anti-racist churches I'd ever been to at the time. Further, this was not very long after my halfway wake-up during college. Looks like racism really is right, and white people really are in danger from the mud races and the Jews. Fantastic, huh? I quietly stewed for some time, thinking I could just ignore it. I had moved for work reasons to Kansas City, which is a bit like a mini St. Louis, so you can imagine what I thought of the inhabitants. I could deal with it for a while, since my area was fairly safe and the company I worked for only had a couple token niggers. That didn't last, and I was forced to deal with reality. It finally dawned on me. Race is real, and it matters. I knew ever since the housing collapse happened that we weren't going to fix this country unless we dealt with the minority issue. After all, giving home loans to talking animals that couldn't pay them back wasn't such a good idea. There were a few other racial epiphanies along the way, but they're not worth going over in detail. Further, Obamacare had passed right when I was coming to these conclusions, and that more or less made me want to leave the country. No, I'm not kidding. I'd had enough of America. The political system is broken, and the passage of Obamacare proved it. There was so much effort against it that it shouldn't have passed at all. These sorts of decisions are made well in advance, and no amount of politicking will ever change them. So there's no point in trying. Long story short, there's nowhere to go. I was stuck in America. I started reading Stormfront to blow off steam. I was smart enough not to ever post on Stormfront or even set up an account, but I needed something to look at which at least let me process some of what I was thinking. Someone, and I can't remember who, but some kind soul, had posted a remark like, you know, there is a solution to all this, with a link to northwestfront.org. And of course, being of the mindset I was, I clicked it. Let me stop here and point out more clearly something I said earlier. I was ready to hear the party's message. I knew this country was in real racial trouble, and there wasn't a political solution. I was already anti-American on both principle and practical grounds. I knew, from many small lessons that added up to one big new racist understanding, that our racial problem is bad and getting worse, and that something had to be done to protect and save white people on at least this continent, if not the whole planet. Someone decent enough to post the party website where a white nationalist might see it showed me there was a solution. I had come to the right conclusions, and my mind was in the right place. Because of this, I gave the party serious consideration. There is no other solution, and we're approaching the time where we will have to make hard choices about survival. I took the time to go over the party website and considered very carefully the Butler Plan and the idea of asymmetric warfare to force the federal government to abandon the Northwest. At first, I thought it was nuts. But as I considered the idea and researched the methods being proposed, I realized it could be done as easily as Mr. Covington claimed. I worked up the courage to provide my real name and mailing address to the party, so I could get an intro packet, and I started reading the Northwest Independence novels. I made the commitment to migrate and took it seriously as I described. That serious mindset and deliberate preparedness for homecoming is what it took for myself and every other migrant to succeed where it matters the most. So I have to ask the audience what is wrong with their mindset. I've been contacted by people on Facebook who are considering the migration, but drop all this racism when they get a job again. Apparently, our race is just fine now that they're employed. Contrast that with my experience. I left the best job I've ever had and did so without batting an eye. My mindset compelled me to sacrifice, but we hear from so-called supporters and comrades that they would migrate if it didn't mean giving things up. Apparently, it's all good and well for some of us to make the hard choices and put out the effort, but the rest of the audience is too good for it somehow. Okay, I'm being a huge horse's butt right now, but I'm not saying anything we don't all know is true. My state of mind prioritized certain things above others, and part of the decision to migrate was finally admitting that I wouldn't be okay if I just ignored what I saw around me. And further, if I wasn't going to be able to avoid the coming nightmare, no one would. It was time for me to admit what really mattered and to do something about saving my race. Some of you will make smaller sacrifices to migrate, and others will be faced with much larger, much harder challenges. None of that matters against the goal of saving your race. So I'll leave you with this question, comrades. Where's your mind at? Do you actually believe the things you tell us you believe? Do you actually understand what you're signing up for by opting out of your migration duty and your party participation? Migration isn't beyond your reach, so there's got to be some other reason for the lack of participation on behalf of those who claim they're our comrades. Really, guys, where is your mind, and further, your nationalism at? Hail victory.
As Mrs. and Mr. America fret, they huddle around their TV set, they worry and they sweat. They're thinking I'm the enemy, the one they need to get, because their mind controllers tell them I'm a major threat. The talking heads, the daily press, they cultivate stupidity and harvest ignorance. They point a crooked finger and they're all unanimous by calling me extremist because I'm down on Zionists. So now I want to sing a new song. I want to be an extremist. I want to join a militia and wear camouflage. I want to be an extremist and run around and sing a rabble-rousing rebel song and sympathize with the skinnies.
job done. Now what's so bad about being extreme? If I'm extremely innocent, if I'm extremely keen, if I'm extremely paranoid, it's cause of what I've seen. It's written in between the lines of every magazine. The FBI, the CIA are working for the KGB and getting in my way. Cause they don't like my politics, they dog me every day. I'm getting tired of telling them the problem is oy vey. The enemy is communism. I want to be an extremist. I want to join a militia and wear camouflage. I want to be an extremist and run around and sing a rabble-rousing rebel song and sympathize with the skinheads who realize it was the Germans wrong. I want to be an extremist. I just want to get the job done. Captured by the mob's opposing views, his only guarantee is that he's sure to be amused. Some may win, but most will lose. Their lives are only figments of the thoughts they cannot choose. And I doubt you'll ever see me on the 6 o'clock news, exposing lying, thieving, cheating communists. Who made me sing you this song? I want to be an extremist. I want to join a militia and wear camouflage. I want to be an extremist and run around and sing a rabble-rousing rebel song and sympathize with the skinheads who realize it was the Germans wrong. I want to be an extremist. I want to get the job done. I want to be an extremist and I just want to have fun.
Quick news break. Over the past week, the dictatorship has admitted that they're delaying and switching around fleet assignments in the Navy because they can't afford to refuel the aircraft carriers at Norfolk. At least one carrier will not be deployed to the Middle East because of this delay, so it looks like the dictatorship's starting to have trouble maintaining its oil empire because they're running out of money, like I said they would. How long before they can't keep their drones in the sky or their spy cameras on every street corner in operation? It's beginning, people. Secondly, the dictatorship several days ago ordered 30,000 illegal third world aliens with criminal records released from prison, again on the grounds that the regime is running out of money and can't maintain them in custody. Now, under the dictator's executive order halting all arrests and deportations of illegal beaners, there was an exception in that beaners and other third world illegals could be arrested and detained, not deported, just locked up and fed and housed at taxpayers' expense, but they could be arrested if they committed crimes. This was because it looked really bad for the regime with all these illegals running around murdering elderly white people and running down whites in their cars while drunk and abducting and buggering their 10-year-old female cousins, which seems to be some kind of Mexican rite of passage, so forth and so on. Well, now they're releasing 30,000 of these things. God knows how many white people are going to be robbed, raped, murdered, carjacked, and otherwise harmed by these brown beasts that are being let loose. But hey, they're future Democratic voters, so they get a pass. Now that's another reason for you not to give up your gun and not to run away and bury it in the woods somewhere. Now you know it might not be the militarized police and the black body armor who kick in your door at midnight. As consumer goods and even basic food becomes more expensive and scarce in Obama's America, there will be an increase in non-white home invasions and crime directed against white people, who will either have some of the last remaining wealth or electronics or AA batteries or just plain food and bottled water, or else who will be perceived by the non-whites as having these things. I mean, you know all white folks is rich, don't you, Holmes? Most deaf. Your guns won't do you any good if they are packed in cosmoline and buried in the woods when your door crashes in and violent criminals with black skins, brown skins, or badges come storming into your home. Okay, before I go into my main tirade of the program, we have time for another quick email. Dear HAC, I'm in a bit of a predicament, and I would very much appreciate your view on this. I am in a position to come home by the fall of this year if I accept an ROTC scholarship. However, if I do accept the scholarship, I'm committed to 5 years in the service. Now, I've been juggling in my head whether or not to accept it or not, because while I would be in the homeland, I would likely not be able to help the unit in the area, and worse, I'd be serving under the Obama regime. On the other hand, if I don't accept the scholarship, I'll be delayed by 3 years or more, and I wouldn't be of any help staying where I am now anyway. I should note that the job I may be able to obtain in the service would be in intelligence. I understand that we're running out of time, and that's why I seek your opinion. Any feedback would be appreciated. Thanks for your time. Signed, Jake. Okay, Jake, I am assuming that you're referring to Army ROTC, which can be double plus ungood. Unlike some, and although I do understand all the moral and practical problems involved, I am not totally against young white people getting involved with the military because it may be a necessary evil. I mean, young white males need some kind of job and some place to live other than their parents' basement or under a bridge. But, that having been said, you don't want to get involved with the Army or the Marines. That is where you will be asked to murder defenseless people in order to steal their petroleum reserves or take the pressure off Israel. Those are also the military arms which may eventually be ordered to physically invade Iran, which means that you stand a good chance of not coming back. Iran isn't going to be like Iraq or even Afghanistan, but the people ruling us are too stupid to understand that. The Army is the most politicized of all the branches of the service. It is now an appalling mess with the lower ranks consisting of drug addicts, gangbangers, and criminals, and mentally ill and third worlders who don't speak English. And many U.S. Army soldiers are mentally subnormal people who have had their test scores altered by dishonest recruiting officers who have to make their quotas, as well as having criminal records expunged, that kind of thing. Now, you don't want to command these troops as an officer, Jake. They're scum, and they will probably shoot you in the back or throw a grenade into your room. In Vietnam, it was called fragging, and it has always been done by niggers who murdered white officers. I also advise young white people to stay away from the Marines because I've noticed a tendency for them to go psycho in Iraq and Afghanistan slaughtering people, which is not a good sign of internal discipline and cohesion in any army. And I don't like the lack of support I'm seeing for their people. I've noticed increasing signs down through the past few years that political correctness is corrupting the Corps as well. It just took a little longer with them than it did with the Army. Basically, the dictatorship is trying to create combat arms consisting mostly of third worlders and politicized officers who are personally loyal to Obama and the ruling party rather than to the United States or the Constitution or the American people. This is not something that a young white man wants to get involved in. If you must get involved with the military out of sheer economic survival because there's nothing else at all available, which, in my view, is the only excuse, try to make sure it's the Air Force, the Coast Guard, or certain technical fields in the Navy. These service branches and MOSs are still very white, and you can actually get some useful training there as well as earning a paycheck. Yes, I know what I said last week about young white males needing a few years in the Army to teach them maturity and responsibility. I meant a real army of white men, not the present pack of shit-skinned murderers and dogs. Now, don't do like I did and join the infantry thinking that you're going to be John Wayne on the sands of Iwo Jima and use your training in the NVA later or whatever. The first NVA direct action, or whatever happens in the real world, will be more like mob hits or gangbanging than anything military. Now, we will not necessarily need military-trained soldiers at first. Like John Wayne said in The Shootist, it's not always being fast or even accurate that counts. It's being willing. Now, frankly, if and when some version of the NVA comes into reality, we will need people who are trained as field medics or corpsmen who can take care of wounded comrades, people who are trained in actual for real intelligence work, people who are trained as armorers and gunsmiths and technicians who can make and fix the technology we will need, trained mechanics who can keep vehicles on the road and customize them with what they need, people who understand the technologies such as drones or CCTV surveillance systems that will be used against us and how to counter them, people with backgrounds in chemistry for reasons I won't get into, so forth and so on. Now, if you must go into the American military because you have no other choice, choose a military specialty that will make you a useful member of any group you affiliate with in the future. Think ahead. To sum up my answer, Jake, if it's Army ROTC you're talking about, I'd say try to find another way. If it's Air Force or maybe even Navy, it might be worth a shot. Okay, main tirade time. Now, 2 weeks ago, I started talking about the Northwest Volunteers, the people who will become the made men and women of our revolution here in the Northwest. I stated at that time that the first thing these volunteers will have to understand and accept is that their commitment to the Northwest Republic is a lifetime gig, and they can't stop the roller coaster and demand to get off if they decide they don't like the ride. Now, since then, I've gotten some questions asking me exactly what these Northwest Volunteers, these people who are completely committed to the Republic, are supposed to do. Okay, I'll talk about that now so that those of you who are really into the concept can start acting like Northwest Volunteers even when they don't yet exist. But I understand that most of you won't listen to me. And by the way, for future reference, anytime I say you need to listen to me, that means you need to actually do what I say, not just listen to me on the computer every week and then click off until next week, okay? This stuff I'm talking about here, I expect you to really do it. We're inching up to almost 6,000 hits on the web per week, so I should hopefully start seeing a little more action from the 1 in 20 of you who are supposed to still have the old Aryan Alpha gene, okay? Right. In a general way, I will expect three things of the Northwest Volunteers. The first thing I want you to do is to speak. I want you to speak to your fellow white people in person, face to face. I'm not asking you to jump up on the table in the break room and start haranguing everybody. Camille Desmoulins may have incited the storming of the Bastille by jumping up on a cafe table, but this is not Paris in 1789. No one is asking you to lose your job and defunctionalize yourself. Northwest Volunteers will require a very large ration of common sense. Nevertheless, there is simply no substitute for personal recruiting and face-to-face conversation. You can spam people with the party website from your computer all you want, and if that gets us hits, then by all means do so. But we need to have a presence in the white community in the Northwest comprised of real, live people, not internet handles, where local white people know who the party is and what we're about because a human being has explained it to them, not a computer screen. Now, when the time comes for the party to begin the process of actual change, then the local people need to know who we are and associate a face with the name, your face, and it needs to be a positive recognition. I do not ask you to harangue others or make a nuisance of yourself. I don't want you to come across as a crank. But with a few obvious exceptions, like your nigger boss and his Jewish boss and the Mexican foreman on the loading dock, your co-workers and your friends and your family will need to know your political and racial views. Otherwise, who will they come to when they have doubts and questions? When they see racial injustice against white people and feel it done to them and their loved ones and they are finally ready to act, they need someone to turn to other than an anonymous face or name on a computer screen. When that happens, these people are far more likely to make a serious commitment to a real human being that they know and trust than to send an email or write a letter to a post office box. If the Northwest Volunteer does his job properly, when the time comes, the local white people will come to him and say, "Okay, you were right, now lead us out of this mess." Also, remember, silence is complicity. When you allow evil to pass unremarked, uncriticized, and unrefuted, then you are accessory to that evil. The Northwest Volunteer may not be a guerrilla fighter. Not yet, maybe never. but he is expected to demonstrate a certain physical courage. When confronted with political correctness, the Northwest volunteer must step forward openly in public where others can see him, see his face, and know his name, and say out loud, "No, this is wrong. I can't stop it, but I will not let it pass in silence." That is what is killing the white race, our own silence. If we can ever end the silence on the part of our own people over what's being done to us, then we've won, because there are still enough of us left in the world, and we still have enough at our command by way of resources to turn the tide if we will ever just stand up and speak out loud what we feel in our hearts. Now, these days, the white man needs a permission slip to do that. The Northwest volunteer in his workplace or community will give him one. By openly going first. Ours is a silent genocide, and it depends on silence to succeed. We are where we are today largely because the white male has rolled over and played dead. Be a man. Break the silence. Now, the second thing I want Northwest volunteers to do is to meet. Yeah, I know that kind of resembles the first requirement of speaking out, but I mean meet people as an actual strategic move to take things off the internet. And the most appalling movement development in recent years, to my mind, is the idea that we've acquired that we can do it all while hiding behind a nice, safe, anonymous computer. The introduction of the internet has proven to be the death knell of the last remaining rudimentary physical activity that white nationalists undertake. Okay, I have been over this about 50 times in the past 6 months, and I won't belabor the point again except to say once more that the people who will make our new republic for us will do so by interacting with other people, not with a machine like I'm doing now. I shouldn't be talking to you right now in this machine. I should be sitting across from you telling these things to you myself, but that's not possible. The Northwest volunteers have to fill my place. They have to talk to you face to face in your homes, in your workplaces, and in person, because I can't. The third thing that the Northwest volunteer must do is he has to resist. I don't think I've ever emphasized this third point enough. By resist, I mean that the Northwest volunteer must commit overt acts which harass, annoy, demoralize, confuse, or distract the racial enemy. The left and the environmental wackos refer to this as monkey wrenching, which is a term I think we need to steal. I ask you to display not only courage, but imagination, resourcefulness, subtlety, intelligence, planning, patience, alertness, and observation. In other words, all the virtues of the revolutionary. I'm asking you to begin the process of striking back. Every oppressed people down through history, with the exception of the white American male, seems to have developed some form of passive resistance suitable to their culture and the conditions under which they're occupied and oppressed. Obviously, I have to be careful what I say at this point, lest I incite, but there are ways that physical resistance can take place without violating any laws. And I think if you folks consider the situation carefully, you'll be able to figure out at least half a dozen ways each day that you can cause the system some kind of grief and live to fight another day. Just a little something here and there to gum up the works, to make politically correct society function a little less efficiently, to cause a little bit more irritation to everybody concerned. You see, a large part of political correctness and a large part of the effort that the system devotes itself to on a regular basis has to do with keeping the lid on a boiling, roiling, multicultural and diverse steam boiler, pressure cooker. The Jews and the lefty libs aren't stupid. They know that the boiler is under tremendous pressure and that the various peoples of this country really despise, loathe, hate each other beyond imagining. Everybody in this country pretty much wants everybody else dead. So your job as a volunteer will be to make it harder and harder for the people in authority to keep the lid on until one day, just through some tiny little crack that they don't notice, that they can't fix in time, the pressure cooker blows completely. This is Celtic Warrior.
Let the battle begin. There's no time to waste. Let the battle begin. And say
united we stand, standing up for a nation's sake. White men and women, together as one, calling on for Europe to awake. Our destiny awaits, the white flame burns, we march on with our flags unfurled. We'll take back what's ours, reclaim our land, this time we're gonna take the world.
I normally don't respond to heckling emails from liberal idiots, but I got one this week which brings up an interesting whine which some of you will have to deal with one day. Not necessarily in public, but perhaps in your own minds when you're going through your mental attic and throwing out all the hippy-dippy, left-wing, sappy crap that a lifetime under political correctness has packed away up there. So I'll go over my own take on it with you now. The heckler was using a female name, which doesn't mean anything on the internet, but she did sound feminine. She had apparently started to read one of my novels, The Brigade, I think, but she hadn't finished it because she claimed to be so totally repulsed by it all. The substance of the whine was, "Oh, Harold, you horrible, wicked, evil man! How can you say such things and do such things to all those poor, innocent, dark-skinned and Jewish people? After all, they're human beings!" So, your point is? I actually didn't bother to answer this cloth-eared bent, by the way, but I'll answer her now. Now, I could give her a long philosophical lecture on how, historically speaking, human life has been one of the cheapest and most squandered commodities in the world. I could point out to her that in the 4 years her favorite mulatto has been in power, he's been responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths all over the world. She wouldn't be able to grasp that, of course, since these deaths weren't on MSNBC or Rachel Maddow, and therefore they don't exist for her. I could have personalized it by referring to the 3 or 4 Americans Barry's whacked with a drone in Yemen, that's that we know about, and the 4 Americans he left to die in Benghazi last September because neither he nor Hillary Clinton could be bothered to leave the basketball court or whatever lesbian encounter she was having long enough to do their jobs and order the military from Italy. I could even bring up that nigger Chris Dorner that the FBI and the militarized police and the black body armor burned alive a couple of weeks ago in Los Angeles. But none of that would have gotten through to her. To people like this, my writing about fictional white people fighting to preserve their existence on Earth is far, far more wicked and evil than the casual homicides which the Democrats and their servants commit every day in the real world. We really have become a completely polarized society, based on a double standard when my writing about white people doing something is horrible and unacceptable, but a baby shit brown dictator actually doing it is just fine. Look, in one of my books somewhere, I talk about a lot of these young white emo types who constantly whine on and on about how life sucks, man. The world is a shitty place, man. No. Life is just life. Everybody has it, and everybody eventually loses it. The world is actually a rather beautiful and wonderful place. It's people who make it bad. Saber-toothed tigers and disease used to be real problems, and they're part of nature, of course. But we wiped out the sabers, and we've got on top of most diseases now, and other than the occasional hurricane and tornado and alligator attack, in modern times, life's problems are caused by people. In my novels, I'm just making a simple observation. If you've got a problem, especially a life-threatening problem, you solve it by getting rid of the people who are causing it, or at least by forcing them to stop causing that problem. That's the way our ancestors did it. That's the way mankind rolled for thousands of years before the Jews wormed their way into our brains and liquefied them. And it's the way we'd better roll again and damn soon, because if we continue to fart around with all this hippy-dippy flower power love everybody rap, we're going to vanish from the face of the earth at the hands of black and brown people whose brains are too primitive to fall for that horse dung. And as for, oh, you can't hurt people, Harold, they've got rights. Well, actually, no, they don't. If nobody has the right to do anyone else harm, then nobody has the right to do you or me harm, and that includes the dictator's servants. Not for money, not because some political gangster in a black robe or some criminal in a silk suit gave them permission to do you harm. They can and they will continue to do harm, like burning that Dorner nigger alive earlier this month, because they're able to bring superior force to bear and take that right. Honey child, I hate to tell you, but there is no more law and there is no more justice. Haven't been for a long time. There have been brief experiments with it in the past, like the Magna Carta, a very noble document which stated that not even the king was above the rule of law. But Obama has placed himself above the law and no one did anything about it, and so there he is. There was a time during this country's early days when we were ruled by law. But that ended on April the 15th, 1861, when Abraham Lincoln called for 75,000 troops to do harm, to force the South to stay in the Union against her will. Ever since then, this land has been ruled by naked force wrapped up in a lot of stupid and self-serving words, and that's all it is today. True, so far the gangsters with the badges and the law books have managed to stay more or less on top of things. But when the dictatorship runs out of money to pay their gun-toters, that won't be the case anymore. Sooner or later, ordinary people are going to defeat the badges and the law books and the black body armor and the drones and the spy cameras and the orange jumpsuits. I hope it's us. But whoever does it, I really hope I can be around long enough to see it begin. It will take a certain kind of white man or woman to do that. I'm often accused of using my novels to try and tell young white people what they should do. Not true. I'm not trying to tell you what you should do. I am trying to show you who you should be if there is ever to be anything left in this land for anyone of our skin color. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.